Good evening, and thank you so much for taking the time to join us tonight at Kivar Capital Partners. Thanks also to those who were unable to be on the call, but were kind enough to send over some questions in advance. I'm Doug Cioka, the CEO at Kivar Capital, and with me on the call tonight are Tom Bowling, John Nemers, and John Nagle. We'll each be sharing some prepared remarks on specific areas of the financial markets and areas of financial planning before opening the call up for questions. Right now, all callers are on a listen-only mode. When we get to the Q&A, if you do have a question for our team, please press star 9 and it will register on our switchboard. We'll invite the question by reciting the phone number from which you have dialed into the call to preserve your anonymity. This is the third conference call that we have conducted since the onset of the COVID crisis, and each has occurred on or around critical points of inflection in its path. Our first call was on St. Patrick's Day, but there was very little to celebrate in the markets. The Dow was less than a week away from what has, to this point, held as its bottom in this cycle, but not before completing a 38% drop in just 19 trading days. Volatility at that time was screaming higher, and panic was pervasive. There was no economic modeling seemingly equipped to calibrate the impact of a global economic shutdown. Markets were literally broken, as the functionality upon which investors have come to depend over the years was fractured, and the ability to efficiently offer price discovery in many asset classes had vanished. It was also 2 days after the Federal Reserve Bank enacted its second emergency interest rate cut. They did that, in fact, on a Sunday. The Fed fashioned a global liquidity lifeline in coordination with the central banks of Japan and England to ease funding pressure for banking institutions. While designed to calm markets, its initial influence was just the opposite, as investors feared that the Fed foreshadowed even larger problems than had been reflected in the swiftest bear market retreat in history. Our second conference call took place on April 2nd. This was 1 week after President Trump's signing of the historic CARES Act. This marked the third round of government intervention to assist in stabilizing the job market and not inconsequentially the stock and bond markets. I think it is fair to say that history will judge the actions of the Fed and Congress favorably, and some would go so far to say heroically. Will there be consequences to the actions they undertook? Undeniably. Will the actions taken to extract stimulus when the economy is able to self-sustain be as swift as those when it was so susceptible? We are hopeful that will be the case, but first, we need to get there. Which brings us to tonight's call. As the world economy contemplates its path forward, as states, counties, and cities begin to phase in the reopenings, and as seemingly not a day or two passes without an innovative evolution on the side of science and its attack on the novel coronavirus pathogen, we certainly sense some optimism in the air, and so has the stock market. Before today's trading session, the S&P 500 stock index had actually moved 32% higher from its lows of March 23rd. It remains 9% below where it started the year and 12% from its February highs. The NASDAQ index is actually now positive for the year, though still 7% below its highest level. We felt that this deserved examination from two perspectives tonight. First, why is the market up so strongly from its lows, despite the economy being undeniably in a recession and with weekly statistics about job losses and GDP declines that are hard to fathom? And second, are the headline indices that I mentioned, the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ, truly representative of what is happening in the broad stock market? To the first point, you may have heard it said over the years that the stock market is a forward-looking mechanism that discounts future prices at a rate reflective of the ambiguity and risk it perceives today. The higher the risk and the ambiguity, the higher the discount rate, and the lower the present value of prices. But importantly, while individuals tend to think in terms of good or bad, markets tend to think in terms of better or worse. Forget stocks for a second and think in terms of the success prospects of your favorite baseball team, likely the Royals, or the expectation of your child's academic accomplishments. It is common to project the future based upon a subset of current and absolute data points, when the actual outcomes are more a subset of relative and marginal data points, indicating progression, improvement, or sometimes the lack thereof. It is important to remember that the stock market is a leading indicator, typically starting its move into a bear market in advance of the economy entering a recession, which it did this time, and typically starting its move into a bull market in advance of an economy exiting a recession. Although the latest moves have occurred at warp speed, history shows that the stock market has actually had its best performance in the highest zone of the unemployment rate, the weakest zone of real gross domestic product or GDP, and the weakest zone of S&P 500 earnings. Just as an aside, we're going to send out a note after this call that will have a number of different charts and reference points that we'll all discuss tonight included in it. The S&P 500 actually has a track record of rising after GDP declines, similar to what we witnessed in the first quarter of this year. In fact, of the 12 prior deepest quarterly GDP contractions on record, the S&P has averaged a 27% gain over the ensuing 12 months. So it is not without precedent that the stock market has rebounded ahead of supportive underlying economic data, but it is incumbent upon that economic data to confirm the advance in a reasonably timely fashion. Otherwise, there is a high risk of reversal. Speaking of market strength, this brings us to the second point. Are the headline indices that I mentioned, the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ, truly representative of what is happening in the broader stock market? Undeniably, no, they are not. The stock market in the S&P 500 is down 21%. The average stock in the S&P 500 is down 21% year to date before yesterday, and about half of those 500 stocks are down more than 30% from their highs. The S&P 500 is an index of the 500 largest stocks in the United States, and it's what's known as a market cap weighted index. More on that in a second. First, some other relevant benchmarks and their performance metrics. The most widely tracked index of small company stocks, what's known as the Russell 2000, is down 24% year to date. The most widely tracked index of international stocks, what's known as the MSCI All Country World Index, is down 20% year to date. And the most widely tracked index of emerging market stocks is down 19% year to date. Interestingly, of the 143 investment categories tracked by Morningstar, only 17 are positive for the first 5.5 months of this year. To put that in perspective, in 2019, 142 out of 143 investment categories were positive. To truly understand the proverbial tail of this year's tape is to understand that the S&P 500 is a bit disconnected from the broader economy. In one sense, isolated from the crisis, and in another sense, actually benefiting from it. This is due to its weighting in technology stocks at over 23% of the index and healthcare stocks at over 14%. These are the largest representations within a market cap weighted index and therefore have a disproportionate impact on its direction. Were you to compare 2020 to the global financial crisis in 2007, when the largest index weighting was in fact financials, they themselves the catalyst for the collapse, then the broader index pain is seen more consistent with the economic drain. The disparity between the market and the economy will eventually compress. This tends to occur as the recovery broadens and deepens, and when more defensively natured companies and sectors hand the performance baton off to those of a more cyclical nature. There are many checkpoints along the path to such a transition, and I'm going to bring John Nagel in now to discuss a few of those with us on this call. John?
Thanks, Doug. For everybody that was on the call or received the slides or listened to the replay from April 2nd, we laid out 10 metrics or indicators that are easily observable that we were looking for in the markets that would give us some increased optimism in a recovery or what would be positive developments and make a good environment for the market to move higher, which it has. But I want to go back and review those, given the market's rise. So first off, we wanted to see a tightening of credit spreads, and we've seen that. Both investment grade and below investment grade, spreads are still somewhat elevated relative to calmer periods and historical averages, and are pricing in a default cycle, but they're still down from their widest levels, from the peak panic. This is an indication of a reduction in that panic for the bond markets. It also shows increasing investor risk appetite, and probably most importantly, that capital markets are functioning well. Next, we want to see treasury yield and inflation expectations rising. These kind of go hand in hand, but both have seen significant rises from their lows in March. This signals future expectations of positive economic activity. It's also another indication of a slowing or reversal of the flight to safety we saw. Modest inflation is a sign of a healthy economy. It's what we've seen in the past 10 years. Very low inflation and the threat of deflation is a precarious position for an economy to be in and much more difficult for central banks to manage. This is why we really wanted to see a positive trend in inflation expectations from the TISP market, and we've seen that. Volatility has also settled down substantially from its peak in March. The VIX dropped below 30 yesterday, its lowest level since late February. The massive swings during March were just not healthy for the market. The fall in volatility has allowed investors to catch their breath, reevaluate, and again, reduces the anxiety of the market. And lastly, from the checklist we laid out, we can check off some of those technicals we are looking for in respect to the level of the S&P 500 for now and re-rate with higher levels to watch. So if you think back to April 2nd, there was a lot of discussion about retesting the lows. If you watch CNBC, seemingly everybody on there was talking about how we have to retest the lows. We never just go straight back up. So for support, we wanted to see that low of March 23rd actually be the low. And if we went in that direction, back down towards it, have the market establish a higher low rather than breaking through and making a new low. So not only did we not retest that low, the market has not even been lower than it was on April 2nd since then. So it's certainly put in those higher lows we look for and built that support. And obviously it's broken out now and also put in the higher highs as it went through the resistance level that we laid out within a week of our call, closed above it, and has rallied well past it. So now we're just adjusting those levels as we're watching the market move. But it's most important in our view to just keep putting in higher lows and higher highs as the market moves up and down. And that's what's been happening. It's a great sign for market stability. Now, a few of the conditions that did not transpire, even though it turned out the market went up anyways. We looked at fund flows. There's been massive flows out of equity and fixed income flows into money market or cash holdings. And investors have continued to favor safety over risk-taking in those funds, mutual funds and ETFs. This is a sign of the prevailing pessimism and skepticism of the ongoing rebound, in our opinion. We also follow a professional fund manager survey and note that their positioning also remains very conservative, overweight cash and underweight equities. So we're yet to see the rushing into the market from the sidelines for those investors that utilize funds, mutual funds and ETFs, a more cautious approach, even as the rally persists. In commodities, we wanted to see less demand for gold as a sign that investor fear was waning. This has not transpired, and it probably tells you more about, again, that prevailing skepticism surrounding the market, and probably more so the skepticism around the amount of stimulus, the debt burden, and the deficit being taken on by the governments due to the crisis. We also looked for some stabilization in the energy markets after the Saudi-Russian price war erupted in March. Oil has actually been anything but stable, with its price going negative on April 20th due to the massive disconnect in supply and demand for energy and excessive demand for storage. It's still crazy to think about paying somebody to take your oil because you have nowhere to put it, but that's what we had. The fact that the market continued to rise with the chaos in energy markets may be more telling about the lack of influence on the broad market of energy stocks today. As of yesterday, the energy sector is only 3% of the S&P 500 now. That's the second smallest sector. And the last observation we wanted to make was positive corporate guidance, earnings surprises, and a general good tone around earnings season from corporate America. And that's just wrapping up now, but we kind of have to grade this one incomplete if we're just looking at this quarter. Nearly 40% of S&P 500 companies pulled guidance due to the crisis and the uncertain outlook for their profitability. We kind of view earnings season as a neutral event to the market as a whole. Obviously, individual companies moved on their own merits, but it just seemed like the market took a wait-and-see approach with most earnings releases. And we'll have to watch the coming quarters as the crisis's impact on profitability becomes more clear. So we'll continue to watch those areas, but we also want to point out three important areas to watch as we sit at this point in the cycle and evaluate what's changed since the last call and going forward. What do we want to see to more or less confirm the strength of this rebound? First, this goes into what Doug was talking about, but as great as the leadership has been from growth stocks, particularly the tech and healthcare sectors, in order for this market to sustain itself, we believe we need to see follow through from the hardest hit areas of the market. Small caps, value stocks, and cyclicals, and for just two main reasons that I'll highlight. Number one, that is the recovery playbook from history. These stocks tend to lead coming out of a recession as the economic recovery begins. Cyclical stock leadership would represent an increase in consumer confidence and activity that makes up nearly three-fourths of the U.S. economy. These would be banks, real estate, retail, restaurants, hotels, travel, those type of stocks. So we'd really like to see participation from those beaten down areas in conjunction with the leadership we've seen from the growth side, as that leadership is more typical of late cycle. The second reason is this, and it's kind of a general thought, but while we recognize the undeniable shifts that have happened in the economy and for the consumer, and that the leadership from mega caps, growth, tech, healthcare makes all the sense in the world and is grounded in fundamentals, it can only go as far as the underlying buyers of those companies' goods and services really takes it. If you think about it, businesses can't create customers out of thin air. And for example, tech is dependent on non-tech as their customers. Small businesses, cyclical industries, and consumers buy and use the software or the service or the component down the supply chain that has made the technology sector so dominant. So without these industries being healthy and functioning and spending money, it will eventually be a negative to the technology companies that dominate the index. So the market needs multiple areas of the economy prospering to push substantially forward in our view. And then the second and third areas, and these are very broad, but we call them the economic green shoots and the recovering labor market. So the economic data appears that it will bottom during this second quarter as reopening has begun mostly across the country. But we have to understand that this could obviously change given the virus activity, a potential second wave in the fall, maybe a different shape and trajectory of the recovery. But we're almost definitely in a recession as we sit today. And while the outlook is uncertain, we'll watch for the first positive data points, and these could even be less bad data points that are commonly known as the green shoots, to start to show up, turn upwards, and signal that a recovery is underway. We'll look for accelerating rebounds off the lows in the PMI surveys, industrial production, CapEx spending, shipping and transportation, retail sales, consumer confidence, housing, those type of data sets that have really fallen off the table to historical low levels. And we'll look for those first signs of rebound. And then the labor market, which is really important. How many and how fast will laid off workers return to the workforce? So far, 36 million unemployment claims have been filed, 20.5 million jobs lost, and the highest unemployment rate since the Great Depression, which was 14.7%, was just posted. So this is simple, and we monitor these weekly and monthly releases, and we'll look for the peak in these numbers to come this summer in unemployment rate and jobs lost, and then move towards recovery. Start adding new jobs and reducing the unemployment rate. Those will be the first steps to recovering from the crisis and getting back to normal, and will be the first positive signs for the economy and the market as a whole. And so with that, I'll send it over to Tom Bowling, and he will fill us in on the health side of things, as well as some financial planning action items. Tom?
Thanks, John. What's clear, and John alluded to a lot of interesting data points in his remarks, what's clear to us as investors, and has been for years, is data informs and drives our decisions and can help us formalize a viewpoint on investment strategy, or help us to draft portfolios and whatnot. It's very clear right now that the market is very focused on the virus, and so tracking data related to the virus is almost as important to us as the underlying economic fundamentals in the short run. So through that lens, we're able to understand the trajectory of the markets. And to Doug's earlier point, the market is focused on better or worse versus good or bad as it relates to data points regarding the virus. So we're focused on three areas mainly. The spread of the virus, testing data points, and then finally, some developments on the treatment side. As it relates to the spread, the actions taken in March and April in terms of closing down the economy really were done with the main purpose of mitigation and also allowing for our hospital system to be able to absorb these spikes in cases in the resulting hospitalizations that would occur. It's clear that we are now at a point where the capacity in the hospital system is ample, and we have achieved kind of that preliminary goal of making sure that the hospital system has not been overwhelmed. To give you an idea, during our last or the peak of hospitalizations across the U.S. in mid-April, reached just shy of 60,000 inpatients. As we sit today, we're right at about 40,000, and certainly trending lower. That line of hospitalizations has been trending lower for some time. That's a positive thing. And again, it's about better or worse, not good or bad. We don't like to see 40,000 people hospitalized, but it's the rate of change that we're focused on. And the result of hospitalizations is, in some cases, deaths. So what are we seeing in terms of that trajectory? Well, it's very clear evidence that the daily amount of deaths has been on the decline since its peak in late April. As of May 18th, we fell below the 800 daily death level. We had peaked at just over 2,000 on a daily basis, which is coinciding with a time where we've seen a spike in cases just relative to an increased amount of testing. Specifically, with regard to cases, despite an increase in testing, which has been pronounced, we now have reached over 400,000 tests on a daily basis. When we did our call in early April, we were just at 100,000 on a daily basis. So we were testing at a rate of four times where we were a little over a month ago, which is positive. And despite that increased level of testing, the amount of cases continues to be on the decline. John spoke a lot about the rate of change related to new cases in our last call, and how we were optimistic that rate of change would not only decrease over time, but eventually go negative. Well, we did reach a negative rate of change here in the last couple of weeks. We've just recently seen a small spike in that rate of change, but it's still along the flat line in terms of daily new cases. So very, very encouraging numbers on this whole concept of bending the curve. Alongside the increase in testing, another positive development has been the rate of positive results of those tests. So again, back a month ago, we were seeing almost 20% of individuals tested for the virus come back with a positive result. Now that number is less than 5%. So a lot of the efforts, mitigation, social distancing, et cetera, have had a positive effect and informed government officials on their next phase of beginning to slightly reopen the economy. We have certainly spent a lot of time in the recent past couple weeks and got a lot of interesting data points over the last 2 weeks as it relates to treatment. That's kind of the next frontier on this fight on the virus. So there's two components to that. There's the antiviral regimens and treatment that are being developed for those that have the virus, and then clearly hoping to get to a vaccine to prevent outbreaks in the future. Just to give you an idea of the scale of the effort that's being undertaken right now, there are currently 216 treatments globally in consideration for antiviral use against this COVID-19 virus. In addition, over 133 vaccines in some stage of development across the globe. We got some encouraging news yesterday from a U.S.-based company called Moderna. While it's in the early trial stages, it's nonetheless encouraging. And I wouldn't so much focus on one company or one result, but in general, the huge global undertaking of research and development in this area is very, very promising to first get us to have an antiviral treatment that can further reduce the mortality rate for those infected, and eventually hand that off to a vaccine, hopefully later this year. You know, the next thing I'd like to touch on is some opportunities in financial planning as it relates to this. We often think about investing in a vacuum and stocks and bonds, the market and so forth. There are other things that improve our prospects individually and help improve our retirement goals, financial objectives and so forth, involving financial planning strategies. We've talked about several of these in the past. I won't spend a lot of time in this area. You know, things like refinancing your house, considering a Roth conversion. You know, another area that we think is very, very important during this period that we're in now is reevaluating your risk tolerance, and not across the board, but selectively with the different pools of capital at your disposal. You know, as we move forward and think about your specific goals, what's the right amount of risk to overlay on those assets? But I do want to spend a little bit of time on estate planning. Not an area that gets talked about a lot, and certainly in this period would certainly be probably lower on the list for a lot of individuals. But, you know, there's some opportunities that have been created by this market downturn for individuals with estate tax concerns to consider some wealth transfer strategies. So think about the depressed level of asset prices, the low level of interest rates. Those are two drivers of certain strategies. One specifically would be grantor retained annuity trusts, where you can gift dollars out of your estate today. And as those dollars grow, the growth can be captured outside of one's estate moving forward. So there's a lot of individuals that may think of their estate as not taxable in the future, just given the high estate tax exemption levels. It's clear to us that that might be an area where there's some revision going forward, just given the need to generate tax revenue. So considering some strategies in that regard, it could be just an annual gift to a family member of a stock or a fund that is at a temporary depressed level that then can grow from there outside of your estate. So, you know, a final word real quick in terms of, you know, the general theme of where do we go from here? It kind of ties into both Doug and John's comments. But as it relates to the response to this pandemic, whether it's the Fed, what's going on in Congress, certainly the biotech and pharma industry, not only domestically, but across the globe, there is a large effort underway to achieve the same outcome that we're all hoping for. It just seems difficult to bet against a positive outcome in that regard. With that, I'm going to kick it over to John Nimbers. He's going to spend a few minutes talking about an area that we don't talk about a lot, is on the employer 401k front. So those that are still employed, what kind of strategies should you be thinking about as you continue to make contributions into those vehicles?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. And as Tom just mentioned, sometimes we tend to forget about our 401k and kind of set and forget it. And many of you guys may be wondering and been looking at our 401ks and wondering, is there anything, any actionable items I should be doing within our 401ks? Well, there are actually a couple of items you may want to be considering, starting with reviewing your 401k and looking at the portfolio and making sure it is aligned with your risk tolerance. And as Tom was just talking about, maybe taking a look and seeing what your risk tolerance is and looking at your current investment elections and seeing if it's maybe set too aggressive right now, or maybe it's not aggressive enough and you need to tilt a little more to have your 401k owning more equity. You may also want to evaluate the fund choices and the lineup in your 401k plan, whether that's strategically looking back and seeing which funds have got, you know, a good history of returns and just had a few hiccups here and there, or looking at expenses, or seeing which funds fit your risk tolerance. Are there any changes you guys can make in dropping or adding these funds into your 401k lineup? And then one of the most important and great things to do right now, and as we talked about rebalancing, is to, once you figure out your investment choices and your investment lineup and lining that up with your risk tolerance, is to go in and right now rebalance your 401k. As your allocation, it may be out of line. It may be underweight equity and you need to go in, sell some bonds and buy some more equity. And if possible, take a look on your plan provider's website, and they may have the option. A lot of them do now, but they may have the option to set up auto rebalancing. I would recommend going in and setting this up, whether it's just quarterly or annually, and going forward, have this auto rebalance your 401k going forward. And then last and definitely not least, keep contributing. As 401ks provide one of the best investing strategies using dollar cost averaging, meaning where you buy into the market every couple of weeks, or through 401ks where you buy into the market every couple of weeks when you get your paycheck and make your contributions and buying in the market. It's one of the most powerful tools out there, and it allows 401ks to grow and grow and dollar down the risk of what's going on with the markets and all the volatility. With that being said, that is some of the main points I would target with doing with your 401k, especially during times like right now with some volatility and your 401k lines might be out of line. But that being said, I'm going to pass it to Doug.
Thanks, John. So that concludes our prepared remarks for the call tonight. And as I mentioned earlier, if you have a question, please press *9 and it will indicate such on the switchboard. And then Tommy will identify you by your phone number on which you called in. We did have a couple questions that were emailed ahead of the call. And I'm going to go ahead and take the first one, and Tom will take the second. So if you do have a question, please tee it up, and we'll reach out to you after we go through these first couple that were mailed in from clients that were unable to attend the call tonight. The first one has to do with the energy market. And it was pretty incredible to think 4 weeks ago today that the price of a barrel of crude oil for what is called front month delivery, right? When you look at a price of oil on an exchange, you're looking actually at what's called the futures price. And at some point, the future arrives and it becomes the cash market and the market of today. And the price of the future, when that converts to cash, means the actual owner of that contract has to take physical possession of oil. John Nagel mentioned the energy war that was instigated after the last OPEC meeting between the Saudis and the Russians, with a not so subtle attempt to impact negatively the U.S. Shale drilling industry. And by flooding the world literally with oil, their goal was to drive the price lower. And boy, did they succeed. There was a gentleman named Brian Sullivan on CNBC who made a comment that we've repeated often. We all felt like we learned in math class that you can only lose 100%. Turns out we were wrong. The price of a barrel of oil on April 20th fell 346% in one day. Since then, the price of oil has stabilized, thankfully. And there's really two reasons why, right? Oil prices, like all commodities, based upon the principles of supply and demand. When oil was plentiful and so much was being pumped that the world, as I said, was being flooded with the product, each incremental unit of it is going to be worth less. When you pump all that additional oil at a time when there's just generally less demand because we're in a global recession courtesy of the coronavirus, you have a double whammy. So what's happened is two positive things. One, the world stopped pumping a lot less oil. There's a lot of ways you can gauge this. There are a number of different institutions that report the quantity of oil that's either pumped or in supply on any given day. There's something we watch on every week, what's called the Baker Hughes rig count. And it actually identifies how many active oil rigs are drilling each week in the Gulf of Mexico. The last count, which was last Friday, there were 339 rigs drilling for oil in the Gulf of Mexico. Compare that to a year ago exactly when there were 648. So you've seen that obviously cut in half, which is reducing the supply. As relates to the other side of the equation, the demand, two positive things have transpired. One, countries have utilized what are called their SPRs, or strategic petroleum reserves, where they hold mass quantities of oil in the event there is an emergency need for it. It is not difficult to find. We've not had issues that have required the tapping of the SPR in quite some time, but I think what the pandemic certainly caught everyone, given that the pandemic caught everyone off guard, preparing for low probability situations is very prudent. So the U.S. has done so, as have many other countries, in addition to the fact of the optimism on the recovery and the mobilization, hopefully, of additional manufacturing and industrial production entities that will require that throughput product to make what they are going to sell. Just recently, in fact, this week, the Riverside General Motors plant is firing back up. Anecdotally, that tells us they would not do so had they not anticipated additional demand, which is, as John Nagel mentioned, one of those green shoots. Tom?
Thanks, Doug. Before I jump to this second question that was submitted prior to the call, I just wanted to circle back on one data point as it relates to the virus. I think this it certainly didn't get a lot of press, but there was a study released yesterday from the equivalent of the CDC in Korea. But basically, their findings are that coronavirus positive patients who then test positive for the virus again after being released, so basically re-positive cases, are they're finding that they are not infectious, right? So some of the concern is that we will have this huge swell in the fall, and certainly there is precedent that people can get the virus again, but a very encouraging news that they're finding not to be infectious carriers of the disease. So I just wanted to highlight that point before we move forward. So the second question that was submitted is, are you worried about inflation being significant at this point, given how much money is being printed to bail out the economy? It's definitely a fair question and a relevant one, and certainly something that's on our radar. The fact is we've never seen the types of stimulus and other programs enacted by both the Fed in the Treasury and Congress. And so the short answer is we don't know what this impact will have over the long term. But if we look at past periods when we see rates of inflation increase, we're certainly in a period now of very, very, very low levels of inflation. That's reflected in commodity prices, the CPI index. The Fed has a mandate to get to 2% inflation and has been unable to achieve that for many, many years. That's why that's actually what gave them the confidence to keep interest rates low for so long. But if we do get into a period of time where inflation begins to tick up, which seems rather logical given the amount, the flood of the money supply and the increase in the money supply we're seeing, the question becomes, what kind of investments do well in a low and rising period of inflation? Well, if we look at the four main asset classes, bonds, stocks, cash, and commodities, of those four, the best performing historically in a period of low and rising inflation is commodities. That seems to make sense. Hard assets, think of gold, oil, fossil fuels, agricultural commodities. Some of that I think can be dismissed, or not dismissed, but could be neutralized a bit in terms of some of the energy efficiency policies that have been put in place and development we've seen. So while commodities certainly should benefit from periods of inflation, it's not a guarantee that all commodities will benefit. But the second performing and really the best of the three main asset classes is stocks. So historically speaking, in periods of low and rising inflation, there's been seven instances of that since 1974, stocks have returned about 16%, whereas bonds are at 5%, cash at 2%. When we think of rising interest rates, we get concerned about our fixed income holdings, right? So the value of bonds in a rising interest rate environment is depressed a bit. But there are things that we can do. We can add in Treasury inflation protected securities. We can ladder bond portfolios with individual bonds that allow us to hold them to maturity and not be forced sellers when those bond prices decline. So frankly, we'd like to see a little bit of inflation right now. That'd be an indication that the economy is on the mend and growing. So again, star 9 to ask a question. We don't currently have any in the queue. We'll give it just another minute to see if there are any questions pop up. Doug, I'll kick it back to you. It doesn't look like we have any questions at this time.
Okay, great. Thanks so much, everyone, for dialing in. We really appreciate it. Like I mentioned earlier, we're going to send out a PDF or a PowerPoint with some slides that were the backdrop and source of a lot of the information we were quoting this evening. Really appreciate your ongoing involvement and engagement and certainly your confidence in Kavar Capital. When we concluded our first conference call on St. Patrick's Day, we had commented that it will be fun to look back. Maybe fun was the wrong word. It will be interesting, and we'll be happy to look back on this experience. And obviously, as we're 2.5 months, really 3 months from the day that that transpired, we're certainly making our way. I think Tom hit some great points on the benefits of time in an environment and a society that is known to possess such strong innovation and ingenuity. We certainly wouldn't bet against the science or the economy, and we're very fortunate to have it buttressed by some interesting and innovative stimulus, both monetary and fiscally. And hopefully we can continue to see that trend positively as we make it through the summer. So thank you again for your time this evening and your ongoing confidence in Kavar Capital, and look forward to talking to you soon.